should marry each other.
Huh. We ready?
One second. That's all right. Testing. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. So this week's parsha is Parshas Maaseh, and there's a very fascinating, unique item in this week's parsha that is not really not a part of the law as it is handed, as it was given to the people of the world. In other words, everyone talks about this Judeo-Christian tradition that is quite debatable. Whether we would want to use that term or not. But the bottom line is that a lot of the law that we have in this country, as well as in most of Western civilization, does have its roots in the law of the Torah. And a lot of it can be traced back. But there's a law in this week's parsha that, as far as I know, does not have any expression in modern society, in modern Western civilization, and that is the law of the Ir Miklat. The idea that when a person commits an unintentional murder, when they kill somebody without intending to, there's an accident, a horrible accident. The classic example is that somebody is chopping wood and the handle of the axe flies loose and strikes somebody else who's in the woods and it kills them. So the intention was not there, although the action was there. It's the force of the action that this person put into the axe to chop the tree that ends up killing the person. So that's called an unintentional murder. And that unintentional murder we're told by the Torah, has a very specific punishment, which is a kind of not even really a punishment, but it's a specific situation whereby the relatives of the murdered person, who clearly are going to be quite upset by this, seem to have the right, not necessarily that it's a good thing to do, but if it's understandable, it's understood by the Torah, that if they chase this person down and catch him, that they're not going to be liable for murder themselves, because this person should have taken precautions. If you're going to use an axe in the woods and there are people around, you have to make sure that your axe handle is tied down, is appropriately attached to the head of the axe. Otherwise, in a certain level, there's a level of culpability. Now,
what about a situation where every precaution was taken? There has to be some
situation where every precaution was taken. I mean, that's a good question. Is there such a situation? There's always some level of risk, and the question is, what type of risk is considered acceptable risk under these circumstances? And the answer is, there is none. There is no level of acceptable risk. Meaning, no one could ever claim, listen, it was not b'shogeg. B'shogeg is how we refer to it when it's unintentional. It was not b'shogeg. It was even less than b'shogeg. There is no such category according to halacha. We're going to actually get... You always go to the heart of the matter. We're going to get to that towards the end. But that's definitely a very, very important point. But there is no level of acceptable risk. It's not like we have in today, when the U.S. government, I read recently that the U.S. government has devalued the value of a person. There's a certain value when the government decides on the levels of risk factors and various things, whether it's medications or other types of things, they assign a certain value to each person, like a certain, whatever it is. I think it was something like $6 million, $7 million, maybe $8. And then they take the amount of population that's in that area and they figure out what the cost benefit is going to be for these people in terms of lives. It's really a frightening type of statistic, and they just devalued, I think, by $500,000, how much a human being is worth in their eyes when it comes to making these types of decisions, which is definitely not a comforting thought. But in any case, according to the Torah, according to Allah, there's no level of acceptable risk. If you are participating in some sort of an action that causes the death of another human being, even though you took precautions and you didn't do anything that was overtly irresponsible, still you have a certain level of responsibility, and the Torah provides that you can run to what's called an Ir Miklat, a city of refuge. You can run, if you run to the city of refuge, then once you're in that city, you're safe. The Goel Hadam, the relatives of the person who was killed, have no right to touch you in that city. It's you're absolutely safe there. And by the way, the Gemara talks about how this happened, that they would assign, whenever they heard about, if Beis Din would hear about an unintentional murder, they would assign two Talmidei Chachamim to accompany the person who had done this, right, the murderer, to accompany him to the Ir Miklat, so that along the way, if the relatives would come, they could kind of act as a buffer and sweet talk them and explain to them that he didn't realize what he was doing, that it was unintentional, and so on. So it's not as if it was just completely like the Wild West, and people were just after they killed somebody by accident, they had to go on their own. And also, of course, the Torah tells us that the way had to be marked very clearly. You had to know how to get to the Ir Miklat. So that's what the Torah provides, this concept of the city of refuge. And the city of refuge, there were six of them, but there were really more than that, because every city that was given to the Levium, which was an additional 42 cities, if I'm not mistaken, total of 48 cities of refuge. So if you look at Israel, not a very large place, right? Compared to the states, to each one, to most of the states in the United States of America, is actually tiny. 42 cities in a area that small is quite a number of cities, and so they were easily available. You could get there, and you had this safety in the city of refuge. I don't know of a concept that applies to accidental murder that's similar in any way in Western law. Do you know of one?
Like a car accident.
Okay.
Like if you're driving a car and someone.
Right, it's called involuntary manslaughter, but you don't get to run to a city. And for say, in other words, there is manslaughter, right? There is the concept of a shogeg, of somebody doing something that they, and the law will look very carefully to make sure you weren't doing anything wrong, you weren't drinking, you weren't doing right, and so on. You weren't talking on your cell phone, whatever it is. But the bottom line is, at the end of the day, if it's determined that it's involuntary, so then there's no level of responsibility whatsoever. Maybe there's the level of, the insurance companies will have a certain level of responsibility. But the person is free to go. The family can't do anything to the person. There's none of this mechanism. And running to a place of safety is certainly not done. So there's a few questions that I want to deal with. Yes? There is such a thing in, right.
And they stay there.
Right. Well, just like this, but I don't know if that's I don't think that's for involuntary things. I think that's just churches were known as places of refuge, except for Jews. But in any case, and just like an embassy, if you're in a foreign country, you run to the U.S. embassy, there's a certain level of protection, but I don't think it has specifically to do with an accidental murder. So this concept is specific for accidental murder. By the way, if you do something else accidentally, you don't get to go to a city of refuge. It's only for this one specific thing. So there's a few questions that I want to deal with, and there are many more questions, of course, but we're going to just focus on these. One is, what is it about the Levium? Why the Levium? The Levites are the ones who are the caretakers of these cities. And if you think about it, it almost sounds like a punishment, because if anyone, I don't know if you're living, I imagine, in Brooklyn, but if somebody in Brooklyn says, I want to put like a halfway house on your block, or some sort of, where they're going to be some sort of kind of pseudo quasi criminal. So everyone's going to be signing petitions, not on my block, not in my neighborhood, put them somewhere else. This is not considered something that's good for property value, and it's not something that's good for a neighborhood. So here, although we know that these people did it by accident, clearly there's some level of responsibility, and they have to stay there. We're going to talk about till when they have to stay there till the Kohen Gadol dies. We're going to talk about that soon. So it doesn't seem like the type of thing that would bring up the property value in the Levite cities, which. So you want to know, like, did the Levium do something wrong that Hashem said, you Levium, I'm gonna saddle you with the responsibility of having to be the Ir Miklat? Or is it something beautiful about the Levium? Is it something positive about them? What's going on over here? What's the connection of the Levium? And then, of course, that leads to the next question, which is why do they have to stay there until the Kohen Gadol's death? What is it about the Kohen Gadol? I'm not sure we're going to really get to a full answer of that. We'll get to at least a glimpse of an answer to that question. But like, what does the Kohen Gadol have to do with this person? This person is minding their own business. They're chopping wood in a forest. The Kohen Gadol's in Yerushalayim dealing with the Beis HaMikdash. They kill this person. They have to run to the city of refuge. He's stuck here until the Kohen Gadol dies. What's that all about? The Gemara says that the mother of the Kohen Gadol, as long as she was alive, would always bring treats and food to the people who were in the Er Miklat, so that they shouldn't be davening for her son's for his son to die. What's going on with that? And then the next two questions I think are even more important are what is the significance of this? Like what, you know, everything in the Torah really is supposed to be about us here and now, each one of us here and now in our own lives. So what's the significance of all of this in our daily life? And particularly that question, it's like an addition to that question, is particularly how does this apply to us today, since we are in fact in galus, we're in exile. Those people who had to run to the Er Miklat, it's called that they were going into galus, they go into exile, they have to leave their home, leave their lands where they were born and where all their, you know, experiences are, and now go into this new place and in Gullus. We're in Gullus. So not only what is it, you know, on one level the question is what does it teach us for daily life, this whole concept of having the Er Miklat, of having the city of refuge, what does it teach us about our lives, but what does it teach us about our lives particularly when we are also in Gullus? Is there something particular that it should be teaching us about this situation? So those are the questions that I want to consider.
When did the city of refuge stop? Only when we had the
Beis HaMikdash? When we had a Beis Din that was able to... No, it was only, until there were, as long as there was a Beis Din, started when Yeshua went in, as soon as they went into Eretz Yisrael, as soon as they established the cities, and it ended when there was no longer a Beis Din that could give down decisions on these types of matters. I guess that would probably be till the end of the second Beis HaMikdash somewhere. So I don't know, 700 years, something like that. I mean, it was definitely quite a while. Okay, so now let's talk about it like this. So first of all, on one level, very simple level to understand, the Gemara talks about and Chazal talk about in many places the concept of killing that all of us engage in on a daily basis, and that is the concept of killing through speech, right? That this is not going to be a shiur on Lashon Hara, but just to mention that a clear analogy to the idea of killing accidentally would be somebody, so if you say Lashon Hara on somebody on purpose, so that's called killing on purpose. That's amazing. You did it on purpose. So the Gemara says that actually there's three people who are considered to have been murdered when somebody says Lashon Hara. The person themselves, they're like killing themselves. The person they're telling it to, and the person they're talking about. But let's say a person says Lashon Hara but accidentally. They don't have in mind that, oh, I'm going to say Lashon Hara. They don't even realize it's Lashon Hara. They're not paying such careful attention to it, and they say something that's wrong. So they're a shogeg, right? The shogeg means that you forgot that what you were about to do was asur. So you forgot that it's wrong to say, or you didn't realize that this thing was wrong to say. It's a different level. You're a shogeg. So a shogeg is still, however, considered, it's still considered murder on a certain level. You can still look at it and say that it's murder. So even though, and this is probably true of most of us when we say Lashon Hara, very few people, when they're about to say Lashon Hara, think to themselves, ah, this is Lashon Hara, I really shouldn't do this, I'm going to do it anyway, right? That's not what happens. What happens is somebody wants to say something for some sort of purpose, and they don't really think about it too deeply, and they say it, and sometimes afterwards they'll realize it's Lashon Hara. Half the time they probably don't even realize that's Lashon Hara afterwards because we're so habituated. So it really, most Lashon Hara that we're talking about when we talk about Lashon Hara is the shogeg kind of Lashon Hara, because if we're talking to people who are doing it on purpose, so then we're talking to the wrong audience. They're not going to, they know it's wrong and they're doing it anyway, so what am I going to do, right? But people are doing it with shogeg, so that's an interesting thing. So we have to say, let's say that in daily life, there's a parallel between the concept of killing b'shogeg and the concept of saying Lashon Hara b'shogeg. Well, if the tikkun, if the fixing of killing b'shogeg is to go to an Er Miklat, so it would make sense to say All right, the city of refuge. So it would make sense to say that the tikkun, the fixing of saying Lashon Hara, Bishogeg, of saying Lashon Hara unintentionally, should be to go to some sort of refuge, some sort of place of refuge. Is it a physical place? Is it a spiritual place? What is that place? So the Svarim say that the place of refuge, and it's spoken of, the Chazal, or Chachamim, speak about this in many different ways, but that the place of refuge for a Jew is the Torah, right? The study of Torah is a place of refuge. And if a person goes to this place of refuge, so let's continue the analogy. If they run to this place of refuge, because it says that if a person kills somebody, b'shogeg, so they should run to one of these cities, right? The word in Hebrew that means to run is the word ratz, right? Ratz means to run. So when you run to a city of refuge, so let's talk about when you run to the Torah, but when you run to something, it's very interesting because Hebrew, in the language, there's a lot of relationships between various words that teach us something about each of the words. So the word ratz is part of the word ratzon, which is desire. So because if you think about it, that when somebody runs towards something, so they're activating a very, very powerful will. They're moving themselves physically towards something that shows a ratzon. I want, right? You come home after a long trip and your kids come running towards you. They give you a hug. It's like they're super excited. They're running towards you. There's a strong movement towards that thing. So running towards the ir miklat, right? On the part of the person who's just killed unintentionally, describes a desire to get there, a desire to get there very quickly, a real desire to get there. And if we take that down to the level where we're talking about in our own lives, a person who recognizes that they did something wrong, that they said Lashon Hara by accident, and they want to get refuge from that, so they run towards the Torah. The idea is they're moving towards the Torah very, very definitively with a tremendous, tremendous amount of desire. Now, we'll finish the analogy and then we'll move on to some very, very interesting things. But when we get connected to the Torah in a way that the Torah is, that our kind of consciousness, that our being is in line with the Torah, meaning we are surrounded by the Torah, we are immersed in the Torah to the extent that that's where we live, just as a person who's running from an accidental murder has to live in the city of refuge, in the Ir Miklat. So a person who wants to leave the place and run to Torah, leave the place of accidental Lashon Hara and run to Torah, has to live in that place of Torah. And when they live in that place of Torah and they align their consciousness with the consciousness of the Torah, so that's considered to be a refuge, and harm can't befall us if we're in that place. So that's the analogy on a simple level. If we want to know what does Ir Miklat have to do with our daily lives, it has everything to do with our daily lives because we have this idea of Lashon Hara, which Chazal tell us is like murder, and therefore just like murder unintentionally goes to the Ir Miklat, Lashon Hara unintentionally goes to the Ir Miklat of spirituality, of speech, of the world of ideas, which is Torah, and that exerts a safety net over us as well. That's on that level. So to the question of what does it do with us on daily lives, on a simple level, that's what it has to do. Okay, now There is another concept, and that's what I'm actually going to read a piece. I didn't get a chance to xerox it for everybody, but there's this concept that we have. Oh, I do have something that we can see inside. Let's do that right now. This is a handout. There is a beautiful passage in the Gemara. Here, I'll take it and pass it. Maybe. Yeah. Probably pass it back. So there's a beautiful passage in the Gemara, very famous, because the entire Sefer Mesilas Yesharim was written by Ramchal, or Moshe Chaim Lutzato, based on this teaching by Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. So I have it here on the top in the Gemara with a translation underneath. Tana Rabbanan, the Rabbanan taught, v'nishmarta mikol davar ra. And it says in the Torah that you should guard yourself from any evil thing. Shelo yahara adam bayom, that this teaches that a person should not think immoral thoughts by day, right, or thoughts that have to do with avera by day. V'yavo lidei tuma balayla, and that, therefore they'll come to have tuma at night. This is talking specifically in the area of sexual immorality, but it holds true by all types of immorality, all types of wrong acts. Mikan Amar Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair. So from here, Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair says, teaches that Torah mevi'a lidei zehiros, that the Torah, the study of Torah, brings one to what we'll call heedfulness. This is a translation by Art Scroll, the heedfulness, which he calls, which is zehiros. Heedfulness, I think another way of saying heedfulness, and I would have said, was watchfulness. There's another way of saying it as well. Pardon? Yes, but I would say possibly it means like mindfulness, right? Like,
yeah,
right. I think mindfulness is the best translation. We would have said
watchfulness,
which is also very good. But I think mindfulness is a little bit better, and it certainly fits the shir better. So we use it for the shir. But it could be that there are nuances. And then if you are mindful, so zehirus brings one to zrizus, which is diligence. Right, which means doing things, you know, on time and correctly and so on. And zrizus, diligence, brings one to moral cleanliness, which is nikios, which is a level. And it goes on from there. There's a whole bunch of levels that go on from there. So I think it's really fascinating, because this idea that our consciousness being in line with Torah actually safeguards us and provides us a, so to speak, city of refuge or a place of refuge, that's what Rabbi Pinchas ben Yair is saying. He's saying that Torah, from Torah, you can come to this place by immersing in Torah and by going through these steps that he outlines. You come to the place, and the first place you come to is mindfulness. Now, it's a very interesting thing. That what he's saying is, and this is, remember, it's based on the Pasuk says that a person should stay away from every bad thing, and Chacham would say that means that a person by day shouldn't think about things so that by night they'll come to an avera. What that means is, I believe that what Rabbi Pinchas Meir is saying here, and what the Gemara is teaching us here, is that there is a direct connection between what goes on in our minds and what goes on in our actions. And that, therefore, that's why I want to translate as mindfulness, because mindfulness in the sense, right, if Torah leads to mindfulness, just we could stop right there and say that learning Torah with the proper kavana, with the proper perspective, will bring a person to mindfulness where they can be conscious of their mind and its expression and how it causes things to happen in the actual world. And in fact, they are very, very connected. And when I was learning this today, I realized that this was perhaps an answer to a question that somebody asked me. I don't remember if it was here last week at Arnav. It may have been. It may have been somewhere else. Somebody wanted to know, once in a shir, a long time ago, we were talking about the idea, I think it was here, we were talking about the idea that a Jew is not held responsible by Hashem for negative thoughts, for negative kavanos. Let's say somebody intends to do an avera, but they don't end up doing the avera. So Hashem does not hold them liable for that. He doesn't punish them for that. But a non-Jew, we saw a source that said that a non-Jew who has in mind to do an avera, even if they don't do the avera, they're held liable, they're held accountable for it. So if somebody was asking me last week, it seems like that's really unfair. Right? Why should a Jew be able to, right? That it's not counted, right? And a non-Jew, it is counted. So I was a little stuck. I didn't really know how to answer that. I was thinking about it. And my initial response, or my initial thinking process, was to try to figure out what it is that's special about Jews that Hashem would, what's like negative about non-Jews that Hashem would, like, you know, hold them accountable even for their thoughts, even if they didn't carry it out. But if we understand that mind and body are really one, that the ideas that one has in one's mind and the actions that result from those are really one continuum and part of one system, so then one can say that really that's the way the world is. And the bottom line way that the world should be treated is, if somebody has the wrong ideas in their mind, they should be held liable for them, because they are connected through actions. You can't separate the two. They're part of one continuum. But in the case of Klal Yisrael, the case of Bnei Yisrael, Hashem says, since we have this special relationship between us, where I have taken you on, so to speak, as in a marriage, right? We have this special, unique relationship, and you therefore have certain responsibilities, you have certain responsibilities, and your responsibilities are far greater than the responsibilities of the other nations. So even though the mind, body is right, thoughts and action is one continuum, I'm going to choose to ignore the thoughts when those thoughts don't actually physically manifest themselves into the world, not because they don't deserve to be punished, but because I'm going to give you a bonus because of the relationship that we have, and because you have so many more things to be thinking about and so many more responsibilities. So I don't want to increase your burden, so to speak, that you should. But in reality, don't think that the thoughts are just kind of like, you know, gratis. Like you can think whatever you want and you get off scot-free because you're a Jew and therefore I can think about any avera that I want. But no, it's that I'm going to overlook them, but the natural way of things is that there should be punishment for the thoughts. Yes?
Beinoni, isn't that like a Beinoni? A Beinoni doesn't follow through with action, but...
Right, that could be. Right, that could be. Right, right. I'm sorry? Yes.
She said in one of her tapes, if you have negative thoughts, you can chase them away.
Right. Sure. So now it's a really interesting thing, because in today's world, this is not only a spiritual thing.
So is there any connection to that concept of the negative thoughts, even though we're not held accountable, to a person coming into a situation of doing this Shogeg app?
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, that's exactly what we're going to... So listen to this. So I want to read to you from a scientific blog that is talking about this subject. So I'm going to give it to you from a science perspective.
Keep quiet.
Okay. So Richard Dawkins and his ilk, right? Who are she calls them high level technicians. These are scientists who are claiming the idea of God is unscientific. They are arrogant and appear to lack life experience as well as the imagination to ask big questions. Because many scientists to this day, although it's getting to be less and less, many scientists will say, look, if I can't, you know, measure the results, if I can't do an experiment on it, so the questions are not worth asking, they're not scientific, and since I can't ask scientific questions about God, I don't believe in him, and there's no evidence, and all of these things. So she's saying, they are only rebels against the dogma of religion, and are uninformed about consciousness and spirituality. And she's absolutely right. The reason why scientists, for the most part, have had such a vendetta against religion, this is easy to blame on the Christians. Not everything is easy to blame on Christians, but this one's really easy, because for a very long time, if you had an idea that contradicted Christian dogma, and it was scientific, it didn't matter whether you could prove it or not prove it, if you published that idea, you were basically, you know, hunted down and killed. That was the way it was for hundreds and hundreds of years. So when scientists finally came up with a model of the world that kind of obviated the need for God and the church, and they did so in a milieu where people were ready to hear those ideas, so it became very, very bitter. And of course, the early evolutionists and so on were all virulently anti-religion. And that's where it comes from. It's not coming from a natural kind of objective look at science. And that's what she says, and I agree with her 100%. She says, I've been interested in the role of the emotions in the psychobiology of health and wellness for quite a few years now, and have watched with some amusement over the past years as neuroscientists, using the tools of brain imaging, have published their pictures showing the loci of various emotions like fear, anger, and even spiritual consciousness as residing in or having generative origin in rather specific brain areas. So they do, and they show that this area of the brain deals with, you know, sadness and happiness, and this area of the brain deals with spirituality, and this area, and they actually will have diagrams and textbooks that show these areas. So she thinks that's really amusing. The conclusions derived from the enhanced metabolic activity, blood flow, right, associated with these regions, because they'll stick probes into someone's brain or near someone's brain, and then when they do, and when they laugh and so on, certain parts light up and there's more activity there. So she says this reminds me of the claim that Peter Jennings exists inside the TV tube or the circuit board of the transistor, right, that which is completely ridiculous, right? If you're looking at the newscaster who's on the TV, so you know that it's true right now, right? Not in our, any of our houses, but and I say that purely from a scientific perspective, not from a rabbi perspective, because what I have against television has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with very, very good scientific research that shows that people who have televisions in their homes are not as well informed, not as well educated, and not able to think as well as people who don't. So, not coming from a rabbi perspective. But in any case, if someone does have a television in their house, and somebody's on that television, so the argument that person that they're watching is actually in the television box in their home is completely ridiculous. Yet one could make such an argument if you took somebody and transported them through time from the year 1500, they'd never seen a television, didn't have the background to even begin to comprehend it, and put them in front of a television and said, look, here's this guy, and he would have no reason not to believe you if you said, oh yeah, he's in the box right there. He's just, you know, we shrunk him and put him in the box. Why wouldn't he believe you, right? Why wouldn't you believe? Because, but in fact, so it makes a lot of sense, but we know that it's completely absurd. So she says the same basic thing, to say that just because what you see is activity in a certain area of the brain, to say that therefore everything that results from that on the outside is specifically coming from that place, is just as absurd. And she says, in fact, the expression of the emotions is more correctly viewed, at least to my thinking, as extending throughout the body-mind in a continuum, not localized to a discrete site, certainly not the exclusive province of the brain. Okay, so she has a whole model. We talked about this, a little bit last week or the week before. She has a whole model of understanding emotions and the way people feel things in the world that discusses, yes, the brain is the kind of control center, and so therefore things are somewhat, it's a regulator really more than a control center. Her model, which I don't have a quote for it here, but her model is very interesting. She says that if we didn't have brains, then we would be so, and this is, you have to think about what this does to the classical model of the brain. Classical model of the brain is that the brain is where we understand things and where we feel things and that's the center, and it's all happening there, and it's kind of like processing signals that are coming back and forth from our body, but that's really where the center of these feelings are. What she says though is that if you removed a person's brain and theoretically they could still have consciousness, not that she's saying that could happen, but let's say somehow they could, then the problem with such a person would be that they would have no regulator, and they would be so overwhelmed by the feelings and emotions and things that were going on in their body that they wouldn't be able to deal with anything, and therefore they would shut down. So the question of a person living without a brain becomes a very interesting question. Is that a person can't live without a brain because they can't live without a brain because they need the brain to have feelings and animation and all of those things, or is it because they can't live without a brain because they would be way too animated and too emotionalized and so on, and they wouldn't be this regulator that kind of like allows things to be processed in a healthy, schematic, somewhat predictable way, so that a person could it's like the nuclear reactor. You know, if you took a fan and plugged it into a nuclear reactor, right? So you and the fan and everything for miles and miles around would cease to exist, right? Why? Not because there's no electricity there, but because there's way too much electricity. So it could be the same type of thing, that without the brain regulating and managing all the feelings that are going on. Now, the reason why she believes all of this is because on a scientific level, when you look at the cellular level, so the mechanisms and the chemicals for these feelings exist everywhere in the body. As a matter of fact, and not only that, you talk about the heart, they have discovered, and I'm not an expert in any of these areas, I'm just a total layperson who enjoys reading about these things, but they have discovered recently, and over the last couple of years, that there are processes in the heart that are exactly identical to brain cells. Absolutely identical to brain cells, and they know that this is the case. They're not sure exactly what they do 100%, but it certainly makes sense, therefore, when somebody says, oh, I'm heartbroken, right? If you're processing the same exact chemicals that your brain is processing when you feel sadness in your heart, so to localize it in the heart at that point makes a lot of sense. But even more than that, when they do heart transplants, which are becoming more and more common nowadays, so this has been studied, and it's absolutely held true in most, I don't know about most, but in many cases, the person who receives the heart for quite a while, a number of weeks afterwards, will take on the personality traits of the person whose heart they received. Yes, there are a number of studies that have been done about this. It's not imagination. Literally take on the personality qualities. Now, eventually that goes away because, this makes a lot of sense here, because if we're talking about the brain being a regulator and there's still the rest of the body that's functioning, so those brain cells can't really compete with the whole system that's already been in place, and it's a continuum. So it gets absorbed into the continuum. However, it does have its own kind of place in own distinct place in there. So she's basically saying that the mind-body is one. To say that the mind is the brain and the rest of it is just the physical body is an old-fashioned, incorrect picture. But rather, the mind-body together is the mind. That it's one and the same. Yes.
Isn't it true that the mind rules over the heart?
Right. So when the Torah says certain things about the mind and the body and so on, that's not necessarily a contradiction to this. Because it's true that the mind has to rule over the heart, because that we call the heart the seat of emotions, and we call the mind the place of intellect. And when we put on tefillin, when men put on tefillin, when I put on tefillin, depends on different menhagim, but I wrap three times over here, which represent the three levels of intellect, and seven times over here, which represent the seven levels of emotion. And so we definitely, in Judaism, see these as being the realm of the brain versus the realm of the heart and so on. But that doesn't mean necessarily that they're completely distinct. That's just a way of describing them, and there's no, that I know of, I'm not an expert in this area either, but I don't know of any area of the Torah that says that this is actually physically, scientifically, the way that it works. That there are three levels of intellect in the brain and that all emotions come directly from the heart. I think it's pretty obvious that these are meant to represent certain things, that there's some very deep pictures of a human being that where the head represents a certain ideas. And the heart represents certain ideas. I don't know if it's necessarily meant to be taken scientifically speaking. And I would argue that when you start seeing the way that the Torah and certainly the deeper Torah and the Kabbalah, they talk about the holistic view of a human being as being the sum total of those three levels of intellect and the seven levels of the heart, and how all of those different levels as they are on, like, let's say the spirit chart, how they represent the different parts of the body and so on and so forth, and the different, so clearly when you look at the totality of a human being within the framework of the Torah and the deeper Torah, it's clearly looked at as a complete wholesomeness, and where we say certain things have a representation in the head, certain things have a representation on the arm, but to say that the second you disconnect them, then they don't make any sense anymore. They only make sense to the extent that they're connected to the whole, right? The whole model, if you'll see sometimes, when they do this, there's a like a body chart where they chart the spheros. So all the spheros only make sense if each sphera is found within all the other spheros, right? So you have all the levels of the spheros in each one. So what does that mean? Because the entire thing is one holistic view of a human being. And so that's really what she's saying. As a matter of fact, one of the most amazing things is that I heard a speech that she gave. Her name is Candace Perk. She said that she prefers, she says, the old model of looking at a human being is to look at a human being kind of like as a... like a hunk of meat in a sense. It's like a system that's kind of contained and like it works a certain way. It's like a machine, right? She says she prefers to look at the human being as like the flame of a candle, because it's constantly flickering in and out of different states, given the physicality of the body and the emotions of different parts and how this whole mind-body thing is working. And if that's not Kabbalah, I don't know what is, right? The Kabbalah talks about the human being the flame of a candle, and that the neshama is the flame of a candle. So when I heard that, I was like, my mouth dropped for a minute, because I never imagined I would hear a scientist come up with a Kabbalistic description of the totality of a human being. But there you have it. So that's what she's saying. Let me read one more quote. If mind and its emanation consciousness suffuse the body, and in fact extend beyond it, we may consider the role of our personal choices in the creation of our reality. We may consider the role of our personal choices in the creation of our reality. For it is the physicists who have informed us of the primacy of the observer. So what she's saying is that if it's true that that a person is a totality, a mind-body continuum, so then there really is no difference between the thoughts that you're thinking and the actions that you're taking. It's just a matter of how it manifests in terms of other people, but in terms of your system, it's really one and the same. And therefore, one has to take, one can and should ultimately take responsibility for the totality of their system, which means taking responsibility for their thoughts, because it's, you can't separate thoughts. So if this is true, and I believe that's what Rabbi Pinchas Ben Yair is saying, I think that's what the whole Maseilas Yesharim is about. The whole Maseilas Yesharim is about taking this idea that the Gemara is teaching us, which is that if a person thinks, it's like this, the Gemara is so beautiful because it says it in such simple terms, but then when you start thinking about it, it becomes stays simple, but at the same time becomes like the deepest thing in the world. It's simple. If you're thinking bad thoughts during the day, it's going to come to bad actions at night. So the Gemara is telling, right? That's what the Gemara is telling us. So the Gemara is telling us, don't think that they're separate things. Don't think that your mind is separate and you can think and imagine. And, you know, in some modern psychology textbooks, they encourage fantasy. They encourage people, because if you live in a fantasy world, as long as you know that it's fantasy, so you're able to, get things out of your system, whatever it is, and then that's considered to be a healthy thing. The Gemara is saying, no, that's not true at all. Because if you get lost in your fantasy world, so you think, oh, that's disconnected, it has nothing to do with reality, right? Anechta getug, as they say in Yiddish, right? Right? It has everything to do with reality, and it will affect your reality, and if you think it's not going to affect your reality, you're very, very mistaken. And that's the whole process of Torah. The process of Torah as a city of refuge is a process of getting in touch with reality, getting in touch with the reality of Torah, which teaches us that it's all one continuum, and the way that we can, and because after all, and Torah itself really can work in this way. There's many levels that you could say this on, but one level would be, you have Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebal Peh, right? You have Torah Shebichsav, that's the written core of the Torah, and you have Torah Shebal Peh, which is the application, and it's the minute you try to separate one from the other, right, you're going to be in a lot of trouble. You can't understand Torah Shebichsav without Torah Shebal Peh. You can't have Torah Shebal Peh without Torah Shebal Peh. They are one. They're two distinct entities that are complete, that form together to create one holistic system of the Torah. So once we say this, so now we say like this. Now we'll just finish up with these following ideas. In Kabbalah, many times there are, right, we know that numerology, the numbers of things, play a very, very big role, and the way words work and so on. So the word miklat, if you can do the homework and check this out in the parsha, the word miklat actually appears 10 times in this parsha. 10 times. And of course, the number 10 we know in Judaism is a very important number. You have the 10 ma'amoros, which Hashem created the world with, right? The 10 utterances, the 10 dibros, the aseres ha-dibros, the 10 sayings that Hashem said at Har Sinai. You have the 10 makos, you have the 10 spheros, right? 10 is a very, very important number. And the fact that it appears 10 times is suggestive. But it gets even deeper than that, because if you look at the 10 times, you'll find that you can divide them into two. Now, we know that when Hashem gave the Aseres HaDibros, so He gave them as 5 and 5, and there are 5 that have to do with the mitzvos ben Adam lamakom, the mitzvos, the commandments that are between us and Hashem, and 5 that have to do with the mitzvos ben Adam lachaver, between human beings and other human beings. So you'll find that the 10 occurrences of the word miklat in this week's parsha are divided into two. There's 5 and 5. The first 5 are impersonal. They're not personal. They are, it says, ir miklat, or le miklat, right? But it's to the miklat. The second 5, which appear a little bit later on, all are personal. They are miklato, to their miklat. It's a personal, a much more personal connection, right? So, in a sense, what this is hinting to is, number one, the idea of the Torah being a miklat, the Torah having to do with, in a sense, the impersonal work of Ben, I was called Ben Adam Machavero, in a sense, over here. Not because it's external, it has to do with externalities, right? As opposed to you probably could make an argument the other way also, but yeah. The personal work that one does with Hashem is totally internal. Nobody else really knows about that work. So that's, I think, perhaps you could argue that's the more personal even of the two. But it goes even deeper than that because there's a two-way street happening over here. And the two-way street works like this. When a person goes into a new reality, right? Remember, we're talking about going to an Eir Miklat or going into the Torah. When a person enters a new reality, so there are two things that happen. There's the person, as the person becomes absorbed into the surrounding area, and then there's the person and the things that the person absorbs from the surrounding area, right? So when you have, let's take the Jews, for example, because we have moved around quite a bit in our history. So when you bring Jews into a town, right? So what you create is a certain, historically speaking, a certain economic benefit, right, for the city, and a certain element to the city that wasn't there before. But the Jews, in turn, will also absorb from their new environment things that weren't there before. So that's why you'll find different minhagim that come from different places that are clearly influenced, not caused, but clearly influenced by the surroundings, right? The chazanus, for example, just a simple example, the chazanus of the Sephardic communities, right, that is clearly influenced by the music that was being played and sung in those worlds, in the Islamic world and in those worlds, right? Whereas the music of the Chazanim, let's say, of Germany, right, in the 1800s was certainly clearly influenced by the music that was going on in the 1800s in that part of the world. So there's an influence of the impact that we made on the environment we went into and the impact that the environment makes on us. The word miklat actually has both of those meanings in it, because likolet means to either absorb, but it also means to integrate, right? When you go to when you make aliyah, what do they call it? A klita, something, merkaz klita, right? An absorption center, right? Merkaz klita, but it works both ways. When you're in the merkaz klita, I would assume, I hope that this is still true, at one time it was true, right, that there were government employees who would work with you to try to figure out what your skill set was and what you have to offer society and try to find you a job and so on and so forth. So they're trying to integrate you into the society of Israel. At the same time, you are trying to integrate the society of Israel into yourself. So therefore, as a way of kind of doing that in a healthy environment, you go to a Merkaz Klita to be able to have that time to figure out exactly where you want to live and to get to know people and to get to learn the language better and so on. So there's an absorption going, it's really a two-way street. So the truth is, that's really what it means to get to it. What does it mean to go to an Eir Miklat? To go to an Eir Miklat means I have to go to a place where I am going to contribute to the city and I am also going to take from the city. So now we can start, right? So let's, before we get back to the Eir Miklat, let's just say on a personal level, when we go to Torah as an Eir Miklat, when we realize that we've been doing things that are negative, whether it's Lashon Hara or anything that's negative, right? Negative thinking, that's part of our whole mind-body continuum, that's part of who we are, and we want to get out of it, so we have to go to a new place. We have to go to a place of refuge. That place of refuge is Torah. We have to be open to absorbing Torah into ourselves, but we also have to be able to contribute. Right, there's a tremendous, tremendous, that is the interrelation between, by the way, Torah Shebichsav and Torah Shebalpeh. Torah Shebichsav you can't contribute to. You cannot, the Torah Shebichsav has very, very solid boundaries. It was written exactly the way it was written, as Hashem dictated to Moshe, and you can't add. You saw you want to add a pasuk. I think this pasuk would go great right over here. Sorry, you can't do it. But when it comes to Torah Shebalpeh, there is also a structure and there's a tradition and so on. But if somebody has a chiddush to say and somebody has something that they want to contribute to Torah Shebalpeh, there's certainly, and not only are they encouraged to, that's part of learning Torah, right? You go in the Beis Medrash, that's when somebody comes with a chiddush, it's like, wow, why is that great? Wouldn't it be better to go learn what they said, what the Rishonim said? The Rishonim had better chiddushim. Yeah, but that's not you're not contributing to it. You're not being part of the process. To be part of the process, to utilize the Torah as a city of refuge, you have to be able to take in Torah and you have to be able to give out Torah. In that process of integration and at the same time, like integrating, and we'll call it, you know, it's like we've talked about this before, that when we talk about the word assimilation, it also has two meanings. And people always say, oh, assimilation is a big problem, right? So it's true. It's a big problem when you take the word assimilation to mean that people are assimilating to the other culture. But the word assimilation really means, in its proper English usage, means to assimilate in, right? It's come to mean both, right? So, and there are numerous indications in Chazal that one of the reasons we are in Galus is to assimilate. Not to assimilate to the other cultures, but rather to assimilate their cultures into us, to take the best. It's a clear Chazal. Chazal says we were sent out to the nations to take the best of their societies and so on and so forth, to assimilate them in. And at the same time, if we do act in a proper way as Kiddush Hashem, right? And if we're able to integrate into the society in a way, right, like Shmuel HaNagid, right, was the general, he was the Gadol Hadar, and he was the general of the Spanish armed forces, right? It would be like, in today's terms, it's completely unimagined. Imagine like, 25 years ago, where Moshe Feinstein, who was sitting in Brooklyn, Paskening Shilas, the Posek Hadar, was also, like, on the side, the general of the armed forces of the United States of America, right? It's like impossible to imagine, but that's what Shmuel HaNagid. So that's a case of assimilation working both ways in a kaddosh way, in a healthy way, but that's really the idea over here also. So when we go to Torah, we go to Mikla, and then that's amazing thing, that when you go if you look the next source that I have, the Yerushalmi says, telling Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, it's a misprint, Eliezer ben Yaakov Omer, Miklat ksiv b'parshas drachim. That when there was a sign, when you came to a fork in the road, they had to put up a sign to tell you which way was the miklat. So they doubled it. It said miklat, right? And so you would think, now that would be like you come to a fork in the road and it says New York, right? And it's not talking about the song, right? So it's like what do you got to repeat it? Or Philadelphia. What does that mean? I know it's Philadelphia. What, I have to have two? There's a sign that says two. So I think one of the reasons that you can say is exactly what we're talking about over here, that Miklat, because it's telling you that there's two purposes of going to the Miklat. You're not just going there to save your neck, you know what I mean? You're not just going there physically to save your neck. You're going there, yes, for you to take in the safety of being in that city, and that you're also going to give, and you're also going to go through a process where you are growing and giving through that process. Now we can understand why it is that they would go to the city of the Levium. Because the Levium are those members of Klal Yisrael who are not given a regular chelek, they're not given a regular portion of Eretz Yisrael, they're not given fields to plow and businesses to run and so on and so forth, except for what they need for their immediate needs. They are the guardians of the Torah. They're the guardians of the Torah. They're people who are, they're the Kolel people of the early times. They were supposed to be sitting and studying the Torah, except when they were on duty in the Beis HaMikdash, right? Pardon? And teachers. So the idea is that where else, if a person has to now go through this process, that's not only the physical process of saving their neck, because why did they kill somebody by accident? If somebody, when we look at a human being now and say that a human being is a holistic whole, so now you can say that when they had that axe, and they chopped that tree, and the axe handle was loose, don't think that you can divorce the action from your thought processes. And that's what you were talking about before. Is there a level that's called acceptable risk? The answer is no. Because it's a person, when a person does something of that magnitude by accident, what it means is there's something about the holistic person that kind of was a part of leading to that. It's not a Western civilization way of thinking. In America, we do not think that way. If something happened accidentally, it was not my fault. I don't bear any responsibility. I can walk away and go to sleep at night without a problem. It's not my fault. But that's not what the Torah says. The Torah says if you're doing something by accident that has, it's you're killing, you're taking someone else's life by accident, don't think it just started there. There was a process. There's a holistic process that's in play. It's a mind-body relationship. It's not just your physical action. You can't divorce it from everything. And therefore, but now you're stuck because you may not even know what it was that brought you to this place. Right? A person is not always conscious of all the negative things that they were thinking and so on and so forth. So now, what does a person have to do? They have to go to the Ir Miklat to be with the Levium. The Levium sit and they study Torah all day and they teach Torah and they're involved in Torah. There are many, many indications of Chazal. I don't know them all. And I saw it in a Maariv HaShem Chemish. I didn't get a chance to look at it carefully, but all sorts of interesting gematrias that have to do with Levium and Tshuva and the process. And we certainly know that the personification, who's the personification of the most perfect Levi? The most perfect Levi is the Kohen Gadol. Right, the Kohen, right, the Kohanim or Levim too. Right, the personification is the Kohen Gadol. So the Kohen Gadol, of course, clearly represents Tshuva, because you see on Yom Kippur, who is it that goes into the Lifnai V'Lifnim, into the Kodesh Kodashim, and does the Kapara for all of Klal Yisrael? It's the Kohen Gadol, right? So a person said Miklat Miklat. You're going to the Miklat. Don't think that that's just to save your neck. It's for the dual purpose of reconnecting in the healthiest way your actions, your body, to your mind. You have to go through a process that includes soul searching, includes surrounding yourself by Torah, taking in the Torah, giving out to the Torah, reorient your entire holistic self to a place of tikkun, to a place of fixing, to a place of being worthy of the kapara, of the atonement that comes from being in the Yerem Miklat. So it's not just a physical thing that you run to the Yerem Miklat. It's a very spiritual thing, and it's something that we ourselves have the opportunity to go through any time that we choose to recognize that some of our actions, although we don't think that they're our fault, but we choose to take responsibility for them. And by doing so, and in doing so, we say, well, I can't help it. I can't change it. I've been doing it for 100 years. I can't, you know, I'm habituated. The answer is go to an Yerem Miklat. Immerse yourself in Torah, recognize that it's a miklat miklat, that there's a dual process that you have to take in the Torah and you have to give to the Torah. It has to be a two-way street. You have to become, and which represents, of course, both the ideas of thinking and action, right? You have to take in the Torah, you have to give back the Torah. It's not just about coming up with a chiddush. It means keeping the Torah and working on mitzvos and doing actions that are in line with the Torah. And through that process, a person can go to an ir miklat in their own lives and come out with a kapara and not... And have a place of safety, but more than just safety, a place of healing that the Ir Miklat is for the person who killed accidentally. The Torah is that Ir Miklat, is that place of healing for those of us, as all of us do, who sin accidentally, who do things that we don't really want to do, but we don't understand exactly how they came into being. So we go to the Torah to reconnect those two, and the Torah is for us an Ir Miklat. My bracha, we should all be zocha to be able to use the Torah as an Ir Miklat, starting from this moment and on. Yes. The reason why?
The miklat and that whole setup is the answer why a Jew is absolved from not being responsible for a son, because the whole Torah is set up to
exactly
as an antidote to that. But by the non-Jews, there is no antidote to it.
That's right. So the natural way is that thoughts are culpable. You're culpable of your thoughts. But since we have a process of Torah that we can use to connect to kind of reorient our thoughts and to make them and to holistically deal with them.
Non-Jewish society, they'll always say, but you did a bad, so you're not guilty, even though the people themselves will always feel guilty. Of course, then they get all schizophrenic about it because they feel guilty, and then yet they're being told, you have no guilt. Thank you.
That was really beautiful.